The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norton, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. Here's round one to test their respective vocabularies. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words right. Begin with Anne, Anne Scott James. Anne, what is a pseudologer? P-S-E-U-D-O-L-O-G-E-R, pseudologer.
Well, pseudo means false.
Mm-hmm.
I should think it means a member of parliament. It means somebody who never tells the truth.
Yes, I think so. I disregard your previous gloss and give you two marks. It means a systematic liar. All right, quickly on to Frank Muir. Frank.
Why? I'm not a systematic liar.
We'll see. Frank, what is or are oughts? O-R-T-S, oughts.
Oughts? Oughts?
Mm-hmm.
They're promptings of the conscience. I ought to go and see my mother this weekend. Well, for a girl, I ought to say goodnight here, but do come up for a cup of coffee. Promptings of conscience. Oughts.
Spelling went wrong this time.
Bits left over.
Yes.
Bits left over.
My charming and incredibly talented partner thinks it's bits left over.
Oughts.
We call that shepherd's pie.
Yes, ever do. It's a pretty archaic word anyway, but they're refuse or leavings or scraps, particularly of food. Comes in Shakespeare. Let him have time a beggar's oughts to crave. You've got your two marks. Tell us, Powell, what is the meaning of raptorial? R-A-P-T-O-R-I-A-L, raptorial.
Something means snatched away in a dream.
Something to do with snatching, so.
Snatching. An abduction. Abducting. No?
Seized.
Seized?
Mm.
That doesn't help.
Seized, as you might say, up.
Oh.
Or.
having a kind of rapt fit.
Nope, I don't get it. I'm sorry. It means predatory. As of birds of prey, people like hawks and buzzards and owls, they come from an order of birds of prey called the raptores, people who sort of snatch things. Now, Dennis Norton. Dennis, what is a pottle? P-O-T-T-L-E, pottle.
Pottle?
Pottle.
Soppy word. Pottle. Well, it looks as though it could be a poodle whose mum had an affair with some cattle. or it could be a small pot.
Yes.
But then that would make...
That'd be a potty.
Well, no. That would, on that logic, a bottle would be a small bot.
Which it isn't. It ties up with potty.
Sort of word connected with the old Shakespearean tavern, do you think?
Yes, I think it's a thing. Tankard, yes. Or something like that.
Yes, you're getting nerd. One and a half.
It's a half of bitter.
No, it's bigger
it's
than
a quarter
that.
Of bitter.
Oh. No, you're going the wrong way.
Oh.
It's a former measure of liquids, usually half a gallon, which is rather
a
large
big
than a quarter.
Bitter.
That's a lot of bitter, yeah.
But it's also a small wicker or chip basket you could use for strawberries, like a punnet.
Right.
So there's the two. One and a half. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and the two women members of the team will, I hope, go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, your quotation is, "The least said, soonest mended." And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, "I did but see her passing by."
We are 12.
Too early, Frank. And at the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Well, then, round two is a round of odds and ends. 2 marks for correct answers. Anne Scott James, what is a sob sister?
Oh, well, it's a press or journalistic phrase for a female journalist who writes what's known as human stories.
I thought you'd played that awfully straight, Anne. You get your 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is an Oxford frame?
Oxford frame? Hmm. Oh, this is in the dates of medieval times, when ladies who did tapestry, petit point or gros point, worked on a frame, and these frames were traditionally made from the yew trees, which had to be found in the village of Fame near Oxford, and that's known as an Oxford frame.
I can give you half a mark for sheer effrontery. Oxford frame is a picture frame so made that the wooden sides cross each other over at the corners and project for an inch or two. And a long time ago, I think, it was used for framing photographs of college groups and teams and things at Oxford and elsewhere. We don't see them quite so often nowadays. That's an Oxford frame. Half a mark. Dennis Powell, what is known as Socratic irony?
Socrates was always telling a long story and asking questions which made his pupils admit to something which he was trying to teach them.
Yes. Socratic irony means leading on your opponent in an argument by pretending that you're ignorant. And so he gets a bit overconfident and becomes confused and ties himself up in knots and therefore loses the argument at the end when Socrates finally delivers the knockout punch. Now, Dennis Norton, if the House, when referred to by politicians, means the House of Commons, what's referred to when the House is mentioned by A, members of Oxford University, B, financiers, and C, poverty-stricken chaps?
Can I answer
three
the
questions.
Last...
Yes.
Can I answer the last part first?
Yep.
And the first part last?
You can do whichever you like.
In the middle, I'm in the middle. In the middle. Then I might take the first one again and come back to the last one.
The House, poverty-stricken people.
Well, the House... by finances is the stock exchange.
Yep.
A poverty-stricken people, I would say it has two meanings. Hmm. It's either the workhouse...
Yes, that'll do. Members of Oxford University.
I'd hope you forget the first one if I talk long enough and fast enough. What is it? Oh, my friend here who hangs around these places rather more than I says it's Christchurch.
Absolutely right. Well, now we have a round of origins and derivations. 3 marks if members of team can define the present meaning, first of all, and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Anne Scott James, it has the ring of truth.
Well, it means it sounds true. Mm-hmm. Seems true to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I should think it comes from... Perhaps it means a coin, does it? Does
yes.
It come from a coin? Yes, you
yes.
Sort of go, you know, you bite it between your teeth or you slam it on
yes.
a metal table.
And what
and
happens
if it
then?
Has the right sort of ring, it's the gold's okay.
Okay, that's jolly good. Well done. 3 marks it is. Well, now, Frank Muir, the cobbler should stick to his last.
Oh, it means a very much-used expression nowadays. It means you talk about what you know about and... You stick to what you know.
Yes, and by origin.
The cobbler should... cobbler is the last is a tool of a cobbler. So when somebody says, shoe my horse, and the cobbler says it doesn't need... Oh, no, man, isn't it? Man comes in and says, I need a new pair of shoes. And he says, and that suit doesn't look too pretty either. He says, never mind the suit. Just get on with the shoes, matey. Do you mind, Squire?
Sorry, good.
That's,
very nearly got there. 2 out of 3.
What's wrong with 3 out of 3?
Well, It means, as Frank says, stick to the subject you know something about and don't interfere in matters which you don't know so much. But it comes from an original story of a Greek painter called Apelles, and he had painted somebody with shoe fastenings on his sandals, and a cobbler who came and had a look at the painting pointed out to the painter that he got it wrong. And the painter, Apelles, admitted this, and then the cobbler got a bit conceited and said, well, I don't think the legs are right either. And Apelles replied, keep to your trade. You understand shoes better than I do. You don't understand legs or anatomy. Dennis Bauer, he is a stickler for detail.
A stickler for detail? Mm-hmm. Well, it means he's very, very careful about the smallest detail.
Yes.
Stickler.
Comes from what?
Where does stickler come from?
I don't know, but he'll have a rotten explanation. Stickler.
Painting? Going to do with painting?
No, it doesn't. No.
Doctor? No, not
no, if you were no? having a contest, somebody has to look after it.
Well, a kind of umpire.
Mm-hmm.
With a whittled stick to keep the score, is that it?
Oh, when you sort of mark it off on a...
No, I was trying to help you.
You didn't succeed there, Jack.
I think 1.5. A stickler for detail means somebody who's terribly particular and insists on or stands out for all the details, even the most unimportant ones.
You know that bit. Go on to the
That's right. Sticklers were the people appointed as umpires in tournaments or wrestling matches or as seconds in a duel between two chaps. And they had to make certain that every particular point of punctilio and etiquette and fairness was observed. It comes from an old English word meaning to arrange or to regulate or to set in order. Stickler. 1.5. Dennis Norden, Middlesex.
We'll play out time with this one.
Stick to my last. Well, definition of Middlesex. John Betjeman said it's the county that's strangled by its friend London.
Yes.
How did it come to
how
be called
Middlesex?
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Well, in the olden days, sex. It's so nice to be able to do this with a clear conscience, because sex didn't mean what it means today. It meant Saxon.
Yes.
So much for your Latin lovers, you see. The original meaning of sex is Saxon. So don't let them tell you different. And there was Sussex, which is South Saxon, and Essex, which is East Saxon, and, this is the clever bit, in the middle. Need I say more?
Brilliant. You're absolutely dead right and well done. They lived in the middle between the East Saxons, the South Saxons, and the West Saxons, that is Essex, Sussex, and Wessex. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Least said, the soonest mended.
Well, I should have thought it was just a proverb.
Yes, I think it is.
Traditional.
I don't think... I can't really fault you at that one. I think that is 2 marks. It turns up certainly as early as the 15th century, and then it comes in a play called The Shepherd's Hunting by George Wither in the 17th century, and it's also mentioned by Dickens in David Copperfield and in the Pickwick Papers, but originally, I think, a proverb, too. Now, Dennis Bauer, the origin of your quotation, which was, I did but see her passing by.
Well, it's a song.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lady sweet and kind.
Yes.
Was never face so pleased in her mind. I did see her passing by, and I shall love her till I die.
Absolutely right. Well, now I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back to Dennis Norden and his quotation. Least said, the soonest mended.
Well, I think I should explain about Mrs. Flora Treadgold. Because, see, it was on these very grounds that she is suing her landlord. She has a diamond necklace that is insured for £4. That's the weight, not the... As you will gather, she is stinking rich, and her great passion is houses. Each of them has some kind of very weird and way-out feature, such as an indoor skiing slope. But her latest one, it was one of the weirdest. She rang up and she said, "You must come to my latest housewarming. We've got a sauna bath." Now, I didn't really know what a sauna bath was. You know, you sort of inquire around, and people are rather vague about it. And they say, well, it's they have them in Scandinavia, and they're very hot, and you go inside and you roll about on the snow, and they beat you with Twiggy. You know, it's... or... You know, something like that. Anyway, I turned up, you see, and it was a magnificent house, and they got it very cheap, apparently, because of this sauna bath, you see, because the previous owner had died in it. He'd apparently gone inside and got the temperature up to about 110 degrees, and it was just about when he reached the consistency of a peeled shrimp. Went to go out, found the door stuck. It was all, you know... sort of cooled my enthusiasm a bit, you know, for the whole idea. But she said, no, it's perfectly all right now because it's been repaired. The landlords have assured me it's perfectly all right. And my son, Walter, is going to sort of christen it officially in a minute. She said, come on, Walter, everybody's waiting for him. He was standing in that toweling robe, you know. And said, inside. And he said, oh, not alone, Mother. And she said, what do you mean? He said, well, look, if we're going to have a sauna bath, he said, we must do it the right way, the way the Scandinavians do it. It should be mixed. Now, they've got this au pair girl. You see, her name's Gia. Comes from Italy, and she's one of these girls, got this kind of figure, you know. She looks as though she never exhales. You know what I mean? And I, it was only then I realised she had one of these toweling bathrobes on as well. And Mrs. Treadgold looked a bit sort of shocked. And also, don't be silly, Mother. You know, it's only going to be 10 minutes, that's all, and we're both out. She said, no, right. She said, both went inside. We stood about outside and sipping this champagne and eating little things on bits of toast, at each one of which cost the equivalent of a week's housekeeping. 10 minutes go by. 20 minutes. Half an hour, and she went a bit green, Mrs. Threadgold, after half an hour. She sort of tapped on the door and said, are you all right, Walter? This kind of muffled voice came from in there. The door's jammed. Consternation. Mrs. Threadgold, all over the place, throwing her arms about. Walter's in there, alone in there, with a naked Italian at 110 degrees. About five of us got together and we barged at the door, you see. It didn't budge at all. An hour goes past. 2 hours. Walter, speak to me. I'm all right, but Gia's fainted. What are you doing? I'm giving her the kiss of life. Which he did, apparently, for about another 3 hours. And then about four, the door just opened. And they both just sort of walked out. And I thought they looked in extraordinarily good spirits, considering their ordeal. It's very strange, isn't it, the way people can come through things. Another very strange thing was that I noticed there was a key on the inside of the door, which he put in his pocket. But I do sympathise with Mrs. Treadgold about these sauna bath things. I think it was very wrong to have sold it to her under these conditions, and I'm with her in her suit against the landlord for the non-repair of her property. As she put it herself, the lease said the sauna's mended.
I don't know about the rest of you, I felt slightly cheated. And we go on to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, I did but see her passing by.
one of the most beautiful lines, beautiful, beautiful lines ever written, I think. It was actually written by William Shakespeare. In the year 1590, young Shakespeare was an actor in London at the Curtain Theatre, living in Diggs and spending his evenings at the Mermaid Tavern. Bit quiet, you know, in those days, because the plague was coming on. It was about 3 or 4 years to go before it struck. But lots of people were feeling poorly and had the lurgy and were staying in. And he was alone, except a very, very thin, pale boy, visibly undernourished, came in through the door and warmed his thin hands at the fire. Very poorly dressed in ragged fustian, and on his feet, torn buskins, so old that they were really tramkins. "Hey, Ludling," said Shakespeare in his quaint but noticeable Warwickshire accent. "What doeth thee hither, if at all?" "Sire," said the starveling, "sire, I am a well-educated youth without place. I have no money." "What's your name, son?" He said, "Bertram, sire." "Bertram. Bertram Culpepper." "Oh, I..." "How do you eat, then, Ludling?" "Well, I come into the taverns where the rich people eat, and sometimes they have lots of puddings, and if there's some sherry trifle which they don't consider good enough for them, I can snap it up and pop it in my mouth. I am, you might say, sir, a snapper-up of unconsidered trifles." "By X." "By X," said Shakespeare. "That's a lovely line." He said, maybe you can help, lad. Can you think of a title? I've got this Jewish gentleman, you see, he's a moneylender, and this other friend is lent the money on this consignment of goods. And the boy said, what sort of consignment of goods is it, sire? He said, well, I'd say, you know, it's anything, doesn't matter to the plot. I'd say gum arabic and spirits and Chinese lacquer. He said, why not call it, sir, the Merchant of Varnish? It is. He said, just one more, lad. He said, I've got this thing in the back. It's only a sort of thought at the moment at the back of my mind. This Danish gentleman, you see, he's got awful trouble at home and with his mother and his dad and his girlfriend, and he can't make up his mind, you know. And he said, is he obviously a tragic figure, sire? He says, oh, aye, he said, he doesn't hide it, he parades his doubt, he wears it pinned on his arm, he does, like a black armband of mourning. He said, then why, sir, why not call it simply armlet? "By heck I will," he said, lad, I want to reward you. He said, you're obviously poorly, you're obviously underfed. I'd like to render you aid. Will you accept ninepence? And so, Will Shakespeare went home. But you know, creative people are very extraordinary, and when you help a creative person, in order to conserve his ego, he has to pretend that, in fact, he has helped you. So when Shakespeare got back, he wrote in his diary, "Became beneficial tonight. Benevolence overtook me. And this young fella, Bertram Culpepper, I gave him money." And he said, so I write in my diary, "aided Bert C., a poor, thin boy." Now, that doesn't sound much of a line, does it? Because that's the line Shakespeare wrote. But set to music, it is a beautiful, beautiful line. Set to music, that comes out. "Aided Bert C., a poor, thin boy."
By your vote, Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories, but nevertheless, Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden win the entire contest by 4 marks, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.